This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in today. Microsoft sees millions of little opportunities. There they are, sitting in their desks, using scissors and glue, and maybe a Microsoft laptop and virtual reality headset. Today, Microsoft introduced its plan to get its software in front of America's school children in a new way. Here to tell you about it is GeekWire co-founder Todd Bishop. Hiya, Todd.
How's it going, Bill?
It's good, thank you. So I didn't realize that Microsoft has lost a lot of ground in classrooms to Google, that Google dominates in the classroom?
That's right. I think people think of Windows still as the dominant operating system, but at least in the U.S., in U.S. schools, Google has more than 50% of the operating system market, and that's thanks to Chrome OS and the Chromebooks from Google and its partners. And what you saw today was Microsoft really trying to fight back against that and simultaneously take a swipe at Apple with a brand new laptop.
Okay, so let's talk about how Microsoft is swinging. What are they introducing for the classroom?
A new operating system called Windows 10S, and that is a way for schools in particular to run essentially a stripped-down version of Windows. It only runs apps from the Windows Store, but there will be a full-fledged version of Office 365 coming to that store, along with a bunch of other apps. And it runs programs in a way that is protected. So they're in a container. The idea is that these devices will be as good at the end of the school year as they are at the beginning, because they're essentially managed through the cloud and through a web-based service called Intune that Microsoft will be offering to educators and schools to manage all these devices, which is a big challenge. If you're an educator or a teacher, essentially, you're facing a lot of the same issues that IT administrators are in companies, and potentially worse, because I think you'd argue that kids might be putting worse things on unmanaged devices than people at their office desks.
Right. That could be a problem. All right. Well, that sounds all efficient and well-managed. But to what end? What is Microsoft's vision of the 21st century school?
One of the components of what Microsoft announced today was mixed reality. Now, Microsoft has its HoloLens headset, which essentially takes virtual objects and layers them over an image of the real world through a headset. But it also has a number of partners coming out with headsets that do something similar under a platform it calls Windows Holographic. And part of the idea with these devices that are going to be coming to the classroom, basically laptops from Microsoft's hardware partners that are as low as $189, plus a new laptop called the Microsoft Surface laptop that's going to start at $999, is that they'll work with these headsets. So if you can't afford to go on a field trip, perhaps you'll have content to be able to view the wonders of the world through your lens, literally. And that's part of the vision. Microsoft announced a partnership with Pearson, the education content giant, technology giant, to create a lot of that content for those devices.
So Todd, for a parent who is trying to persuade their kid away from gadgets, what is Microsoft's pitch and the experts' pitch who agree that this is the way to go for our little children?
There are certainly efficiencies that you can learn more. Obviously, there is a risk. Boy, we deal with this in my own family, just in terms of screen time and kids experiencing a virtual version of the world instead of a real version. That said, there's a lot of power in the ability to not only just access the web, but to experience the world in new ways. One of the tools that Microsoft offers through this is a way for teachers to very easily upload content to all of these laptops through a USB key. And so there's a lot of advantages here that Microsoft's touting. That said, Google's strength here is not to be underestimated. The fact that they have more than 50% of the market is very telling. And Microsoft is in the rare position of playing catch up in its Windows business here. Now, we've seen Microsoft have to do that with phones. But when you're talking about notebook computers, Windows is still the dominant operating system out there. And so this is a chance for Microsoft to kind of show its mettle here under Satya Nadella, the new CEO.
I'm talking with GeekWire's Todd Bishop about Microsoft's new push today to gain some of that ground it's lost in the American classroom to Google. What else should we know from Microsoft's big announcements?
So the Windows 10S operating system is one part, but then the really interesting thing, and I think the thing that's going to get a lot of headlines, is this new Microsoft Surface Notebook. It is the latest in Microsoft's hardware lineup under the Surface lineup. And Microsoft's goal here is yes, to sell a bunch of devices. That's part of what they're hoping to do. But the other thing that is that they're trying to show the way to say, hey, this is what a great laptop can be. It has 14 hours of battery life, which they say is hours more than a comparable MacBook. So there's where you have Microsoft going after not just Google and on the low end, but Apple in terms of premium devices.
Battery life.
Battery life. And also just the quality of the device.
Have you reviewed, that sounds very promotional. Have you reviewed this thing yet?
I have not, but it looks good. And I've seen, I have used extensively the Microsoft Surface Book and the Microsoft Surface Pro 4. And Microsoft really does get it in terms of the hardware and their internal focus. They're led by an executive named Panos Panay. And the joke going around Twitter was, may you marry someone who talks as lovingly about you as Panos talks about the Microsoft devices. It's a little over the top.
Uh-huh.
It's a little bit Jobsian. His approach. But Microsoft clearly has a strong vision, at least for its hardware. And this new Surface notebook, the Surface laptop, looks very good. And as you say, though, you have to really get your hands on it. For me, the big thing with Windows laptops and the thing that always just kills me is the trackpad. Apple and the MacBook, they make beautiful glass trackpads that are just amazing. I can't even use a real mouse anymore. I just use the trackpad on my MacBook Pro. Microsoft they got close with the Surface Book, and it's a good trackpad. The third-party hardware makers, even Dell and HP, they still struggle with this. So for me, that's kind of like the litmus test for these laptops. So we'll see what the Surface laptop actually is like.
We'll see. You'll get a chance to try it out if that's your thing. And meanwhile, you've learned about Microsoft trying to take a big swing in the American classroom, where it'd be nice to raise a generation of kids on your products. And that's what's up with one of our big local employers here. And it's Todd Bishop from GeekWire, the co-founder of GeekWire, telling you all about it. Todd, it's always good to see you.
Thank you, Bill.
KUOW's The Record, right back in a moment. KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. The Green River Valley, south of Seattle, has the biggest concentration of industry and warehouses in Washington State. Boeing is there. So is Amazon's Kent Distribution Center. These businesses wouldn't be there if it weren't for a dam upstream. Reporter Joshua McNichols from KUOW's Region of Boom team went to learn about that dam.
Kent is the beating heart of the booming Green River Valley industrial area. Suzette Cook is the mayor of Kent, and when she took office, she was prepared to deal with problems like traffic and jobs. But then, in 2009, this storm surge dumped more water on the valley than the dam upriver had ever seen before. And Cook started to worry about floods, too.
The Green River would potentially have a biblical wall of water coming down and putting everybody underwater. And in places in Kent, it's actually 20 feet deep should it flood.
The river hasn't flooded in more than half a century. It used to, all the time. Every other year or two, the whole valley filled up with water. Daniel Johnson is with the Army Corps of Engineers.
If you look at photos from floods before the dam was built, from flood events, you see a large, broad, shallow lake from Auburn all the way to Seattle.
The lake covered the valley's farms. That flooding is part of what made the valley so fertile for so long. But government officials wanted to bring industry here. A couple of world wars had highlighted the importance of manufacturing. So in 1962, they built this massive earthen dam upstream, up past Black Diamond. It's called the Howard Hanson Dam. And it helped dry out the river valley.
The valley's never seen a flood since the dam was built.
When you see all the development in the Green River Valley, how much of that growth and development can we attribute to this dam?
Probably quite a lot of it. Yeah, I think without that sense of security, without that ability to say we can manage the risk of these storm events, you couldn't have done any of it, right? At most, it would have stayed farmland. And I don't think you'd ever have a Boeing field. You certainly wouldn't have the warehouses. You wouldn't have server farms. That just wouldn't have been practical.
The dam has some concrete parts, but mostly it's made of dirt and rocks. It's a big version of the dams that little kids build when they play in streams. It catches the water running off Mount Rainier and spits it out below in a controlled stream. The water constantly challenges the engineers.
What's that hole right there?
It's just a natural area where it's eroded out a cave, the water seeping down through the hillside.
Heavy equipment's working on the hillside now. They're improving the drainage so that holes like that don't turn into bigger problems. If they didn't tackle the small stuff like that, water could start rushing through, pulling parts of the dam with it. That could cause it to collapse, like a child's dam in a stream. But a half century of vigilance has paid off for the valley below. That's the sound of water mixed with tiny jewels, powdered garnet, actually. The water is being forced through a hole the thickness of a human hair. It hits a sheet of metal with the speed of a bullet. The water easily cuts through the metal.
So it's kind of like plugging your thumb over a garden hose, and it increases the pressure as you do that, and the water comes out harder.
That's Julian Bailey at a company called Omax in Kent. The machines Omax makes can actually cut through a bulletproof vest with water, which doesn't seem weird at all to Bailey.
The Grand Canyon was created by water, right, over time. But if you add pressure behind that water, and if you create a small enough stream, you can cut through any kind of materials.
Companies use Omax machines to make everything from airplane parts to Christmas ornaments. The company is part of a wave of manufacturers that spread across the valley floor after the dam went in, kind of like mushrooms after a spring rain. In the valley, you almost can't hear the Green River, even when you're standing right next to it. The trucks make too much noise as they weave their way between manufacturers and the warehouses and the port. The Washington Shoe Company is one of those warehouses. It's a century-old company.
In the Seattle area since 1891.
Once they outfitted gold miners on their way to the Yukon. Today they design quirky rainwear and have it made in China.
We're known for our character designs, especially with children's stuff. So here we have is a raincoat. This particular one is Hello Kitty.
They also make those rubber boots with bug-eyed cartoon characters on them. If you have a little kid, you know those boots.
So we make a frog boot, a ladybug boot, a kitty boot. We used to do Spider-Man as well.
The boots arrive in the ports of Tacoma or Seattle from China. The boots are split up into smaller boxes and then shoved down metal rollers. This box, right here, might be headed to a mom-and-pop store, or to Nordstrom's or Target, or maybe to the Amazon.com distribution facility that moved in just down the street. Lots of companies are rushing into this valley, and it's building up pressure, like water behind the Howard Hanson Dam. In 2009, when the water rose higher behind the dam than the engineers had ever seen before, down in the valley, the levees almost flooded. It was a humbling experience for Dan Johnson with the Army Corps.
There was a time in our nation when the we can conquer anything mentality was very strong, right? No river is too big, no mountain is too high, no ocean is too wide. There's nothing we couldn't do. And there's a certain amount of that that still is in us. Certainly, we still have those feelings, but you also have to understand that not everything can be conquered entirely.
Standing on the Howard Hanson Dam, Johnson tells me he's proud of what his engineers have done. But he knows they're not gods.
So we've done a lot in this site to build a very good dam, and it does a lot of great things for people downstream. But at the same time, it can't do everything. There's going to be a bigger storm someday that's bigger than this dam can handle.
And the valley could face a catastrophic flood. Hopefully, we'll all have plenty of warning before the water rushes in. And the only objects floating in the valley will be boxes of rubber boots. In the Green River Valley, I'm Joshua McNichols, KUOW News.
KUOW's Region of Boom team is reporting from Renton, Kent, and Auburn this month, and you'll find more of their stories on our website, KUOW.org. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. This year's May Day demonstrations in Seattle may be best remembered for people sharing a joint and a can of Pepsi. Here's KUOW editor Derek Wong. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Bill.
Seattle's May Day was mostly peaceful, but there were some arrests last night.
That's right. Five people were arrested during an unpermitted rally in downtown Seattle. There weren't any reports of serious damage or injuries, but there were some scuffles. Thankfully, nothing serious. Police say that people who were arrested are being investigated for things like attempted assault and unlawful possession. So still some serious suspicions, but overall it was peaceful, and two of the arrested people have already been released.
Derek, you have covered other Seattle May Days. How did this compare to past years?
And it seemed much more peaceful. In terms of raw numbers, just to give people something to think about, last year, 9 people were arrested. Again, this year, 5 people were arrested. Last year, there was more violence. There was a Molotov cocktail thrown at an officer. The person suspected of actually throwing that Molotov cocktail last year was even arrested just last week. So we're still seeing the ramifications of previous violence that didn't really surface this year.
And do we know, we have any idea why it was more placid this time around?
You know, we don't really. And maybe it was the weather, for all we know.
It could have been the weather. But some people were saying, you know, with Trump in office, who knows?
Yeah. Exactly. What police were saying before the whole day started was that one of their top concerns were different factions of demonstrators fighting, like pro-Trump supporters fighting with anti-Trump people.
Mm-hmm.
And as listeners might remember, there was a controversial speech earlier this year here on UW campus, Milo Yiannopoulos.
Mm-hmm.
And police tried to keep the two factions separate. That didn't really work out. So one, you could theorize that SPD may have really honed their tactics about trying to keep people apart so they're not fighting amongst each other.
Right. We may have heard about all the arrests that did happen in Portland and Olympia this time around.
Mm.
So, Derek, modern May Days focus on immigrants and workers. And what kinds of things did people say this year?
We heard a lot from immigrants and advocates for organized labor. And they all said they feel under siege by President Trump because of his statements that he wants to roll back some regulations on businesses. Presumably that would attack organized labor. And that, of course, he, you know, he's famously called for new restrictions on immigration. Our reporter Liz Jones spoke to an immigrant named Blanca, and we're only using her first name because she has legal status under an Obama-era program that has some question marks.
We've seen a lot of growth in, like, violent hate crimes, and, you know, that's really not okay for people to feel unsafe. So there's many things going on right now that it's really not okay for many communities, you know.
Derek, there was something new this year at May Day, which was an organized rally of conservatives, at least self-proclaimed conservatives, who support President Trump.
That's right. I can't remember seeing that in Seattle before on May Day, any organized demonstration like this. The organizers of this particular demonstration said they wanted to be in, quote, liberal cities to encourage other conservatives to feel free to speak their opinions in public in blue cities where they may not feel welcome. Here's one of the organizers, Joey Gibson. He's from Vancouver, Washington.
Well, we've been going to all the liberal areas on the West Coast, kind of encourage and bring faith and hope back to the conservatives that live in these areas, standing up for free speech, and also coming down on the day that's supposed to be really scary, May Day, to kind of help other people. If we're willing to come down here on May Day, then you guys can come out on any other normal day and rally and never have to be afraid of these people.
And there were some tense moments, speaking of that fear that was out there, but there were some tense moments between the conservative group and folks who were protesting the president. At one point in time, bike cops had to separate the two groups, but things also calmed down, and a Cairo TV reporter tweeted some video of the different groups sharing some marijuana.
Hey, look, we all fight, hey. And then they roll some weed, and everybody come together.
It doesn't
matter, the political party.
You mean jail.
So, USA.
I know, nice. So demonstrators also passed around cans of Pepsi. They were making fun of that recent ad that listeners might remember that implied that soda can bring harmony and bring the world together.
Oh, yes. The unintentionally funny Pepsi ad, which if you haven't seen, we'll tweet out a link to that one. Derek, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bill.
We'll link to the Pepsi ad where Kendall Jenner and a can of syrupy, bubbly liquid brings together the ambiguous demonstrators. And the Seattle Times also caught some video of that little spoof, the riff on the ad that happened on Seattle May Day. So we'll tweet that out at KUOW. Hey, it's KUOW's The Record. Drivers in the so-called Mercer Mess in Seattle have been witnessing a minor miracle lately. Traffic there is moving more smoothly, even during the peak commute hours. The reason? New traffic lights. See, most traffic lights around the Puget Sound area are just timed. The traffic going north-south gets 120 seconds. East-West gets 90 seconds, and the cycle repeats. But as Chris Long knows, that doesn't always lead to the best flow. He's the traffic engineering manager with the city of Bellevue, and Bellevue's been using an adaptive traffic light system for the last few years, kind of like the new traffic lights on Mercer Street.
As an example, here in downtown Bellevue, before they put the adaptive system in, our signals all ran a 140-second cycle length in the AM and PM peak. But with the adaptive system now, that cycle length will vary throughout those peak periods as low as 110 seconds and possibly up to 150. By allowing that fluctuation, you can deal with the dynamic changes in traffic a lot easier instead of being locked into a cycle length that's the same for a 3-hour period during your heaviest commute. By having that, the ability to be actuated and adjust that cycle length, you can also deal with incident conditions a little better. So if something were to happen on the 405 freeway, our signal system can ramp up the cycle length to adjust for extra traffic that may be coming off one of the off-ramps and going through downtown streets and then getting back on the freeway again.
And how big an effect does this have on the flow of traffic?
When we first deployed Adaptive here in Bellevue back in 2010, we saw a reduction in travel time on our corridors between 15 and 45%. I mean, some were quite dramatic. And that was on corridors that were already pretty well timed. It's just the Adaptive was able to deal with that with the changing demand of traffic a whole lot better and provide more green time for the primary movements through a corridor like Factoria Boulevard, which was one of the first ones that we deployed.
Then, Chris, here's the question that a zillion drivers have asked themselves. Why isn't every intersection an adaptive light intersection?
The reason is it's not cheap to deploy up front. The expense of putting an adaptive system is far more than the expense to just have the traditional coordinated system. However, the rate of return is very high. If you were to look at the delay savings to the driver and try to monetize that, we used a value of about $15 an hour and put that on the time that saved for every driver that went through these corridors. And our system basically paid for itself in the first year of deployment. So one other element to add to that as to why everyone doesn't put these in is that the systems are very complicated. There was a misconception when Adaptive first came on the market that you could put this system in and then you could just forget about it, that the Adaptive system was going to do it all for you, and that's not the case. There's a lot of tweaking and adjusting and operating and monitoring of the system that's required, and they're not as easy to operate as some of the old traditional systems. So you definitely need to have the staff capacity to spend time monitoring these systems. And just not every agency has that luxury.
Are they finicky? Do they break down a lot?
We don't have any issues with them breaking down. There certainly are improvements that we make on a regular basis. You know, our drivers that are out on the streets of Bellevue know their route far better than we do. And so we'll put in what we think is the best timing and operation for a corridor, and then we'll hear from a resident that says, you know, do you know that this particular left turn spills out of the pocket every day at exactly 4:30? And we'll go take a look at one of our cameras, and sure enough, they're right. And we'll determine we need to make an adjustment there, that our system isn't quite picking up that nuance of whatever it is that's causing that, you know, a business that all their employees get off or a school that's in the area. So
I read that on Mercer, where they've installed these new lights, pedestrians now have less time to cross the street. Do adaptive lights speed up cars at the expense of walkers and cyclists?
I don't know what the issue is on Mercer. Here in Bellevue, we didn't change the amount of flashing don't walk time that was provided to intersections, and we have a standard amount of walk that is kind of our base level at most of our intersections. So we're trying to keep our cycle lengths down to provide more pedestrian opportunities when they are waiting for the signal to get another walk, that it's as short as possible.
So, Chris, knowing as much as you do about how the system works, I wonder, is there anything that drivers do around stoplights that irritates you? You want to tell listeners right now, look, stop doing this, do that.
The number one thing and probably our biggest complaint is drivers that are just in too big of a hurry and they're not looking for pedestrians or bicyclists in the intersection. There's only so much we can do to protect pedestrians from right turning and left turning traffic when they have a walk indication or they're in the middle of the intersection during the flashing don't walk. The drivers really need to be paying attention. And of course, distracted driving is a major issue. We can't wait for autonomous vehicles to be more integrated into the market and more of those safety features there that can help watch for peds and bikes that might be in the way. But until that is fully integrated into all the vehicles on the streets, we need drivers to be paying more attention.
You want to hear an idea?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, you know how when a red left turn arrow turns green, but the driver in front isn't paying attention, and so only three cars get through or what have you?
Yes.
Okay. So, and then honking is not really okay in Seattle culture. So a little honk goes off when the arrow turns green, some little happy signal that says, get a move on, but it sounds nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's no, for I, free. I'm not charging you for that idea.
Yeah. Well, you'll have to run that by some of the downtown Bellevue residents now who, you know, every little noise that the signal makes at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, they can hear it in their bedrooms at, you know, 15 stories up off of the street level. So,
okay, a Brahms lullaby plays when the arrow turns
green.
Yeah,
maybe.
That is the unconvinced Chris Long, the traffic engineering manager with the city of Bellevue. He was very polite about my traffic ideas, not excited. He did tell me about what's a better idea, one that the city of Bellevue is working on now, testing a display system that will make cars more responsive to traffic lights.
It will give you a countdown to when the signal is going to turn green based on what it's seen for the timing of the intersection. And then in addition, what it will do is tell you what speed to travel at to be able to hit the next light green, obviously staying within the rules of the road and the speed limit that's posted. Speed limit may be 35, but if they were just to travel at 32, 33, that they're going to hit multiple signals green. And and some of this new technology is going to help with that.
So there you go. They're curbing your smartphone use while you drive. The legislature's on that. So maybe the cars can make you smarter. You're listening to KUOW's The Record. We're going to make you smart about the arguments for and against a Seattle income tax and give you some ideas for calming down about climate change just enough to actually do something about it. Stay tuned. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. An income tax. It's been declared unconstitutional here, but Seattle wants to do it, thinks it can. And yesterday, all 9 Seattle City Council members voted for a resolution to explore an income tax on households making more than $250,000 a year. That's just one idea. We don't have all the details yet. Supporters say the city could bank an extra $125 million a year with an income tax on high earners. The question is an income tax a progressive move to make the rich pay their fair share, or, like the Seattle Times says, a badly timed idea that hurts more than it helps? Let's talk about this, starting with Seattle Times opinion writer Briar Dudley. Welcome, Briar.
Hi, welcome.
Your newspaper doesn't seem to like this idea. You called it inopportune, another circus, a short-run show for their local audience, quixotic, and a beer bottle thrown onto the field during the ninth inning. What is wrong with getting rich people to kick in more? Doesn't the city need that?
Well, there's lots of conversation going on now about how to adjust the state of Washington's tax system. You have to remember, this is a state issue. It's not a local issue. That's where we're coming from, is that the legislature is in the ninth inning reference is really to what's happening in Olympia, where the House and the Senate are wrestling over big, huge, sweeping tax reforms. You know, two of the three plans on the table in Olympia right now will make Washington's tax system more progressive. You know, we've editorialized saying that a capital gains tax, for instance, might be one way that we can finally fully fund education in the state of Washington. And then along comes Seattle out of left field throwing this beer bottle out that is really a distraction. And it's, in a way, kind of pandering to the base. you know, it's the anti-Trump, Trump-proof Seattle measure,
okay,
which is fine. You know, everybody wants to do that, but is it really the time to go off in this direction when the state really needs help getting past this, you know, hurdle in Olympia to make the state tax system more progressive?
Okay, let's get into that. We also have here John Burbank with the Economic Opportunity Institute, a big supporter of a Seattle income tax. And John, are you pandering with a bottle of Bud in left field? What make the case for this income tax?
Well, Brian is correct in that we have a regressive tax system in our city and in our state. In fact, we have the most regressive tax system in the state of Washington of all the 50 states. And we have the most regressive tax system in the city of Seattle. So that means that we do not have the resources that we need to fully fund public services, goods and services. And it is true that the legislature is dealing or considering a capital gains tax, but that doesn't confront the number one issue that is holding us back, which is the fact that we don't have a progressive income tax. And what the city council has proposed and what we're going to be going forward on is a tax on incomes above $250,000 in full knowledge that this will be legally challenged. That's actually what we want. We want that.
It's a test case.
It's a test case. Okay, it goes to the state Supreme Court. It enables the state Supreme Court to review and reverse their decision from 1935 in which they disallowed a state income tax.
But Breyer is saying that the legislature is already considering a progressive capital gains tax and that Seattle Times is into that and that you're gumming up the works in Seattle.
It's good the Seattle Times is into doing a capital gains tax. We think that's a good thing, too. It is necessary. It is not sufficient.
Okay, so Breyer, we may clearly make the case why it in any way hurts Seattle's cause, because that was the language in the editorial, was that this is hurts more than it helps. I understand you think that the legislature is already working on something progressive, but you seem to be saying this is a bad idea, Seattle. It's going to backfire.
Well, there's a couple things. One, the biggest argument that opponents have against a capital gains tax is that it's some kind of a Trojan horse, that it's will start out a narrow, limited capital gains tax only affecting the very, very rich and excluding houses and things like that, but then it will sprawl out and become a full-blown income tax. And really, the way this thing has come about, it started out as a capital gains tax proposal, and I think there were concerns that it was going to mess up the capital gains stuff in Olympia. So then it morphed into a full-blown income tax that validated the fears of the opponents in Olympia. And, you know, plus Seattle is a hard test case because I disagree a little bit that Seattle desperately needs the revenue for this stuff. Seattle has lots of money. Seattle is rolling in money. It's spending nearly $6 billion a year now. In fact, we had a story a week or two ago saying that it has so much money coming in from the Move Seattle transportation thing, it can't even spend all the money it's got right now. So then along comes Seattle saying, we desperately need this new tax source. You know, that's not really the best argument to make, I don't think. That's not the best way to start a statewide conversation about priorities and needs and spending and things like that.
Okay, so there are a couple different arguments there. That one was that the Seattle has enough money. Your first argument before that was, and I want to bounce that off John Burbank, who supports this income tax. John Breyer is saying that you are, think outside the Seattle bubble, that you are setting a flashing light to people who are wary, are skeptical that Seattle, what liberals really want is to tax even more and more of your income, not just capital gains. Are you sure that that's not a strategic mistake?
It is not a strategic mistake. What we have is an upside-down tax system in which poor people pay about 17% of their income in state and local taxes every year, and wealthy people pay about 2.4% of their taxes, of their income in state and local taxes. So that means that if you are making $21,000 a year, you have to work into March in order to take care of your state and local taxes. And if you have income in excess of $500,000, you're all done paying the state and local taxes by January 6th. That's an upside-down tax system. It's also not very robust in terms of being able to adequately fund public services like, for example, Proposition 1B, which the Seattle Times supported about 3 years ago for universal pre-K. That funding from the bond issue, it ends in a couple of years, and there's going to need to be a new funding source, which will cost at least
$60 million if the city wants to maintain its commitment to universal pre-kindergarten for four-year-olds.
Is that the pitch? Are there other things you want to tell listeners that an income tax would pay for that's not being paid for now?
Actually, what I'd like to talk about is the fact that we had Plessy versus Ferguson, which legalized racial segregation for 60 years in our country, and it was considered established law, and it was overturned in 1954 with Brown versus Board of Education. Well, now we've had for 80 years this tax system based upon a judicial decision, a 5-4 decision, which overturned a vote of the people in 1932 for a progressive income tax. And what we have is a tax system that discriminates against low income and working class people and people of color. And it's time that we overturn that. And the best way to do that is to get this the city of Seattle and the city council to push forward this ordinance, and that will be challenged, and that then will go to the state Supreme Court, and then the state Supreme Court can look at their decision from 1935 and review and reverse that.
Okay, Briar Dudley with Seattle Times. Why could, you know, some legal experts, including University of Washington law professor Hugh Spitzer, has told us that the modern state Supreme Court could very well interpret the state constitution differently from the 1930s the Supreme Court. How can this be a waste of time? Maybe the Seattle gets the ruling it wants.
Well, that's an interesting conversation to have. And, you know, sure, Hugh Spitzer is really smart and understands that stuff pretty well. Phil Talmadge, a former Supreme Court justice, disagrees. There's a good legal debate to be had there. I do still think that Seattle is the wrong messenger in this case, though. You know, if Seattle is so concerned about the lower and middle classes and the tax burden, then why did it pass 9 tax increases in the last 4 years? You know, the local tax burden in Seattle has gone up 22% just in the last 2 years, and Seattle's just been on a bender. And, you know,
well, let's ask you, John's right here. John, why Seattle seemed to be okay with raising those terrible regressive taxes?
Well, let's talk about that. So Seattle is a really good place to start if you consider that Seattle passed a paid sick days ordinance, which is now statewide law, and the Seattle passed an increase in the minimum wage, which is now statewide law. So it seems like Seattle is a really good place to start when you want to move forward progressive measures. Well, that's why we're doing this.
Well, Seattle's a good place for people from outside to kind of use it as a sandbox for these things. But, you know, if you just step away from all the policy discussion and you look at what's hurting people in this community, what's making it unaffordable to live here, what's hurting the cost of living, really the local tax measures are a big part of that.
But aren't the policymakers saying these are the taxes we have?
But they're not, you know, in 2010 when we talked about an income tax, there was an interesting proposal that came out for a high level income tax, but it was accompanied with cuts and other taxes. So it really was progressive.
What about John?
Just more.
That was a good proposal.
What about a revenue neutral like that, right? That will raise the tax here and we'll lower it over here?
So, for example, the sales tax in Seattle comes out to about $250 million. We could abolish that if we had a pretty robust income tax starting at about $250,000. That is definitely possible.
What's driving
the housing prices, though, is really the market. It is not taxes on it's not property taxes. It's the market itself.
Okay, from the real estate market, is there a way? Couldn't Seattle raise more taxes on businesses instead of trying to start up a tax that may or may not be constitutional?
Well, of course, the city can raise any kind of taxes it wants on businesses. The problem with the B&O tax is that it, too, is a regressive tax. So small businesses pay about twice as much of their gross revenue on the B&O tax as large businesses like Amazon. So we have a situation in which not just the taxes on people, but the taxes on business are very regressive. So when we talk about, oh, we'll just raise the B&O tax, that hurts small business, and we don't want to do that.
Okay, so Briar, you have said it's the wrong time for an income tax. When's the right time?
Well, I don't know. Let's have a conversation about it. You know, King County Assessor John Wilson's trying to do that right now. He's rounded up a bunch of former governors. He's trying to begin kind of a statewide salon where we consider how we can make our tax system better, more reliable, more resilient, and less of a burden on particular groups of people. And let's do that. But, you know, having you know, big, strong, powerful political groups come into Seattle and get them to do their will isn't really a way to do it. Seattle really doesn't have the
leadership. You're blaming outside agitators?
Well, you know, honestly, this is large labor organizations are sponsoring this. And
what's wrong with that?
Well, you know, it's fine. Although if one was cynical, one might think that Seattle has tapped out the homeowners, property owners, businesses with various taxes, and to continue increasing its spend, it needs to tax somebody else.
Okay.
And so that we have a cumulative addition of new taxes, and nothing's being reduced.
And that's exactly
we have 1 minute left. Breyer got the first word. John, what's the last word?
Well, the last word is that's exactly right. This is taxing someone else. It's taxing the people who have not been taxed yet. So it's taxing the very wealthy. And in terms of outside organizations, we all live in Seattle. So this is just sort of a joke. I guess the most important thing, though, is that we can talk all we want. We can talk about having a statewide salon of ex-governors to discuss progressive taxation. But what is in front of the city council and the people of Seattle is actually an action that we can take to remedy and to rectify the regressive tax nature of our city and our state.
John, I must go. That is John Burbank, who's making the case for a Seattle income tax, and Breyer Dudley with the Seattle Times. And we have been talking about a test case with the city putting out a proposal for an income tax, and we'll see where it goes through the courts and otherwise. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
KUOW's The Record. Eco-anxiety. It means a chronic fear of environmental doom. And it's a pretty common feeling. You see story after story about how we humans have caused climate change and environmental destruction, and we're not doing enough to change things for the better. Ashley Ahern, the host of the new KUOW podcast, Terrestrial, you're familiar with this concern?
I am not technically suffering from anxiety per se, but I have been covering the environment for more than 10 years. And as many listeners know, it's very rarely good news. Usually it's news about how we've screwed things up, how we should feel guilty, how things are broken and where things are headed. And it's not looking good. And so I have this friend who actually teaches ecology in college classes in ecology. And she said, one of her students said to her one day, and I'll never forget this, it feels like we are inheriting a fixer-upper, that the generation that's coming up is going to have to deal with these environmental problems, the problems I've been covering for 10 years on NPR and here at KUOW. And I wanted to make something new. I wanted to make a pivot in my career and start speaking to those people who are going to have to live with the consequences of the environmental destruction that we humans have wrought on the planet.
And one of the consequences is not just physical destruction, but it is this eco-anxiety. And in the first episode, you get into what goes on in your brain when you're feeling that way. And what did you learn?
Yeah. So, I mean, at first, this term has been around for a little while. I didn't coin the phrase, of course, but when I first heard it, I sort of was dismissive of it. It seemed like, okay, this is sort of what hippies worry about. and then as I started doing more research, this is a very real thing that psychologists are talking about, that anxiety around environmental destruction is linked to post-traumatic stress disorder. It's linked to depression. It's linked to suicidal thoughts and suicide. It's got some major ramifications. And as we see more and more of these, you know, superstorms and Hurricane Katrina, the people that are living through these things on the front lines are affected directly. But the people who are scrolling through this news in their Facebook feeds or hearing it on the radio, it also affects our brains in a very interesting way. And it targets our amygdala, which is this almond-sized cluster of neurons that basically triggers the fight or flight response. So we live in this constant state of fight or flight, but this is not a problem that those responses help with, right? Like we can't flee yet. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so when you're in the moments, that kind of triggers this just existential anxiety, I think, for a lot of people. And so I found this man, he's a filmmaker right here in Seattle, actually, named Chris Jordan. And he has such a powerful story. He was one of the first to document a type of seabird, the Laysan albatross, that is dying on this island. They live on this Midway Atoll in the middle of the Pacific, super remote island. And they're dying with bellies full of plastic trash. And so Chris went to this island and he found these dead birds. And he went around and he was cutting open their stomachs to see what was inside. And here's a cut of tape from that.
It was a white ring of the outside ring of a bottle cap right inside the rib cage of a dead bird. And I remember just this shock. And we filmed it and made a big thing of it.
But that was just the beginning.
And then there was another one right next to it, and another one right next to it. And the amounts of plastic in many of these birds is just so astonishing. It's like a quart of plastic inside a bird whose stomach is supposed to be the size of a ping pong ball.
So Chris comes home from Midway, this first trip where he's seeing this horror firsthand, and he sinks into a year of depression and said he smokes a lot of pot just to kind of like soothe his amygdala, basically, mm-hmm. you know, cope with what he was feeling.
And what did Chris eventually do with that?
So he turns to his friend, the writer Terry Tempest Williams, and he says, okay, I'm going to do a book of the photos just to get the word out about the problem of plastic pollution in the ocean. And I need you, Terry, to help me write an introduction that's going to be uplifting and get people inspired to take action and deal with this problem. And so he goes to her and they sit and they look through the photos together. And Terry just says, I can't get you a hopeful message here. This is horrible to look at. But she does, in her great wisdom, tell him he has to go back. And so he goes back to Midway Atoll and he starts gathering this footage. And I think the key here is that he sees this animal in life and in love. And these birds, they mate for life. The Laysan albatross is an amazing animal, giant wingspan. They fly thousands and thousands of miles over the ocean. He describes them like air hockey pucks. They hover right above the waves and they dip down and scoop up food. And that's how they're getting the plastic, because it floats on the surface. So they fly thousands and thousands of miles over the ocean and then they come back to roost. And the mother and the father will kind of be huddled over this nest. The gestation is like 9 months for one of these, their chicks to hatch. And so they're huddled over the nest together, singing, basically, clucking and chirping, or whatever you want to describe it, to their babies.
And that's what goes on 24 hours, even at night. To sleep on Midway, you have to wear earplugs because they sing and dance all night long.
It's just this joyful. His ability to go back and see them in life allowed him to fully embrace his sadness, believe it or not, because he describes grief as realizing the love that you have for something that you're losing. And that's the metaphor that we're embracing in this whole podcast, is that the planet is changing. We know, scientists have been telling us for years, the planet is changing. And so many of us feel paralyzed and we aren't able to sort of approach it head on and cope with those feelings. And so we just kind of struggle with apathy and hopelessness, and as opposed to love, as opposed to kind of looking at what we have and the beauty in it.
Let's remember why we care so much.
Yeah. And embrace that so that we can move through it.
That's great. Except, Ashley, meanwhile, those birds are still eating plastic trash in the ocean that we threw away.
Yep.
So you still have reason to cry and fear. I mean, so what can we learn from Chris's story?
That the news can be really heavy, and that instead of becoming numb, as I think so many people do as we kind of scroll through the news and try to just not engage with it, when we do that, we deny ourselves the full depth of emotion. We exist on a shallower level. And that what Chris teaches us, I think, and his experience teaches us, is that when we face that grief, when we look at the problems that we have on the planet, that we are going to be coping with, that the next generation is going to be coping with, that takes courage. And until we kind of get clear in our heads about what we're up against, we're not going to be in the right mental space to start tackling these big picture problems like plastic in the ocean, like climate change, that can seem so insurmountable. We got to get our heads straight first, I guess, is where we're starting this podcast.
I like that, because it goes right at the theory I think a lot of us have, conscious or unconscious, that if we're not upset and freaked out and angry and all these things and despairing about the earth, mm-hmm. we're not going to act. We're not going to solve the problem.
I don't know about you, but I don't like living angry. I don't want to live angry. I don't want to live guilty. I want to live powerful. And I think that's what I want to do with this podcast, is find the people who are facing these choices, who are finding the strength to face these choices head on. Like, you know, we're going to be doing an episode about the decision to have children in a time of climate change, or whether or not protest works and is worth it, or how we should be making our voices heard. I mean, these kinds of questions that I think a lot of people are thinking about, whether it's from an environmental lens or not, and looking at it from a place of, instead of anger and outrage, strength. And power and connection. Because one of the other takeaways for me in reporting this episode was talking to a lot of psychologists who are saying increasingly that dealing with anxiety, dealing with eco-anxiety in particular, people find strength in community. People find strength when they're coming together. And so we've also created a Facebook group for this podcast where, after you hear an episode and you want to talk it out, you can come and join other people who are thinking about this, who have questions, who are processing this stuff. So it's kind of creating a two-way conversation instead of just pushing out the bad news.
For those of us who are loners and don't tend to come together like that? Mm. Did these psychologists give you any more tips on how someone listening to you now can move into that more, I guess, accepting yet still active place?
So in the episode, we talked to a clinical social worker in Australia, actually, who has been helping farmers who have gone through the worst drought in that country's recorded history. And one of the things she talks about, this 65-year-old fifth generation farmer on the land there who had to, all of his crops were dying, and he struggles with depression and suicidal thoughts. And I asked her, well, what did you tell him? How did you help him cope with this? Because he also, farmers are often they're loners, right? They're on their land, they're working by themselves or with family members. And she said for him, he had this hobby. He always liked to tinker on old cars. And he'd stopped doing that because the anxiety of dealing with the drought and what it was doing to his land had just kind of taken over his life. And she said she told him to start working on cars again, start doing things with his hands that got his mind off of the big problems that he couldn't necessarily solve right away. And so for me, it's motorcycling. I like being on my bike because I'm thinking about nothing but staying alive and enjoying the wind and the smells and the sounds around me. And everybody has their own way of finding that peace and that just present, being present, I think is the key. And then your brain kind of calms down a little bit. And then you're able to kind of return to the task at hand with, I think for me anyway, a greater sense of focus. And I think the key also is that it doesn't have to be environmental action. You don't have to be out doing beach cleanups to find that peace, although some people do, right? And I think that was a learning curve for me. I kind of felt like, oh, well, if you're going to deal with your ego anxiety or anxiety around the environment, then do something about it, darn it, you know? The truth is, you're not going to be able to do much at all if you can't find that calm first in whatever way you need to do that.
The podcast from KUOW is called Terrestrial, and Ashley Ahern is your host and reporter. Ashley, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bill.
Let's tweet out a link to get that first episode and subscribe to the whole season right now. Join us at KUOW. And thanks for tuning in to KUOW's The Record. Finally today, Hillary Clinton is back in the public eye. Speaking at today's Women for Women International Luncheon, she criticized President Trump's Twitter habit and his foreign policy, and she said her new book reflects on her election loss.
Did we make mistakes? Of course we did. Did I make mistakes? Oh my gosh, yes, you know, you'll read my confession and my request for absolution. But the reason why I believe we lost were the intervening events in the last 10 days.
She's referring there to the FBI Director James Comey and the Russian WikiLeaks, and you'll hear more from Hillary Clinton this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered.